Today's Wednesday, April 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, unprecedented elections that could change for Israel are too close to call.
We understand that the real results we have to wait for, and over the coming days, we'll do what's necessary to form the next government.
The army intervenes in Sudan's protests, warning it'll prevent chaos. Also ahead, advocates are pushing to stop the Trump administration from overturning a rule that allows aggressive wildlife hunts. It's all on today's International Edition. Exit polls from Israel's contested election show that former chief of staff Benny Gantz has won at least as many seats as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The question now is whether Gantz can form a governing coalition. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
Big drama. Blue and White is the largest party, and it's impossible to tell who will be the next prime minister, said the anchor on Channel 13 News, giving challenger Benny Gantz's Blue and White party 37 seats to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's 34 out of a total of 120 seats. Other exit polls had Gantz ahead by one seat or tied with Netanyahu. These are only exit polls, and the results could change once all the votes, especially those of Israeli soldiers, are counted. But if this election was a referendum on Netanyahu, who has served for 13 consecutive years, it showed the public is fed up. Netanyahu faces several allegations of corruption and could be indicted within the year. Gantz supporters celebrated at party headquarters in Tel Aviv, but their excitement may have been premature. Even Gantz's most favorable polls show it will be easier for Netanyahu to form a governing coalition. In a tweet, the prime minister declared a clear victory for the right-wing bloc and said he will start assembling one. The exit polls show that several smaller parties, including one of the Arab parties, did not pass the minimum threshold. Once all the votes are counted, Israeli President Reuven Rivlin will consult with all the party leaders and then ask either Gantz or Netanyahu to try to form a governing coalition. In the past, the head of the largest party has always been given the first chance to form a government. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Here are some of the stories we are following at voanews.com. More than 100,000 migrants have been encountered at the U.S. southern border in March. The U.S. aid chief says Congo's Ebola outbreak is far from contained. The Algerian interim president promises free elections. And Iran labels the U.S. as the real leader of world terrorism. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Aid agencies are urging rival militias in Libya to take all possible measures to protect civilians as fighting for control of the capital city, Tripoli, escalates and casualties mount. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
In recent days, health facilities near Tripoli have reported 47 people killed and 181 wounded. The World Health Organization says 9 civilians, including 2 doctors, are among the dead. It says one doctor reportedly was killed while working as part of a field ambulance service. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says the agency has documented dozens of attacks against health workers and facilities that killed and injured 32 health workers and patients since 2018. He says targeting them is against international humanitarian law.
To respond to this spike in violence, the health sector pre-positioned supplies in advance in order to respond quickly and effectively. Emergency medical supplies and trauma kits were prepositioned in 4 strategic sites. The supplies are sufficient to treat up to 210,000 individuals for 3 months and to enable the treatment of up to 900 injuries.
Jazarevich says the WHO fears a prolonged conflict will drain the limited available medical supplies on hand. An added problem, he notes, is that the WHO is short of cash. He says the agency may not be able to meet the medical needs of the population if donors do not contribute more generously to its $43.5 million appeal. Meanwhile, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, is appealing to all parties to the conflict to abide by their obligations under international law. Her spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, says the warring parties must take all possible measures to protect civilians and civilian infrastructure, including airports, schools, hospitals, and prisons.
The High Commissioner stresses that the principles of distinction, proportionality, and precaution must at all times be fully respected. Intentionally targeting civilians or civilian objects, as well as indiscriminate attacks, may amount to war crimes.
Shamdasani says the High Commissioner is particularly concerned about the welfare of thousands of refugees and migrants in detention centers near the combat zone in Tripoli. She says they are extremely vulnerable. High Commissioner Bachelet urges authorities not to abandon them. The United Nations Monday issued an urgent appeal for a two-hour truce in the suburbs of Tripoli to evacuate civilians. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Well, months of anti-government protests in Sudan reached a new stage over the weekend when tens of thousands of people held a sit-in at army headquarters. As the protesters called for President Omar al-Bashir to step down, troops unexpectedly confronted government security forces who were trying to break up the protest. At least six people were killed, and the army is now warning it could step in again. Naba Mohideen reports for VOA from Khartoum.
23-year-old Suhousam and her family have been marching against the government of President Omar al-Bashir since protests began in December. She says he's going to protest with the whole family. They won't come back until the regime falls. But what started as a march Saturday turned to a sit-in at military headquarters. Thousands refused to go back home. These protesters refuse to stop protesting till al-Bashir steps down. They said they have been protesting for 4 months, since December 19. They have only one demand. The regime must fall down. They won't go backward, won't compromise. Everyone will sit in front of military headquarters until the regime totally falls down. President Bashir on Friday night had called for dialogue with his opponents. Elections, says Sudan's government spokesman Hassan Ismail, are the only possibility for change. Hassan says that the door to dialogue won't be closed. The government's mind will still be open to deal with anything in the political arena. Its hands will be open for anyone, even those who refuse dialogue, who raise their demand to bring down the government instead. But on Saturday, the anniversary of 1985 coup in Sudan, the protests escalated. As security forces moved in to clear protesters, Sudanese troops stepped in, confronting and clashing with security personnel. Loud sounds of gunfire were heard around the military headquarters. Sudan's interior minister said Monday that at least six people were killed in the weekend protests in Khartoum and 2,500 others arrested. Analysts say the protests over food and fuel shortages have snowballed into widespread anger at all aspects of government. This is the political analyst Motasim Ahmad. He said the street protests are a result of accumulations lasting for a long time. The inaccessible power structure and defensive approach of the government eventually resulted in failure. Late on Monday, Sudan's defense minister issued a statement through state media. It said the military understands the reason for the recent demonstrations, but will not allow the country to fall into chaos. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
U.S. Attorney General William Barr on Tuesday declined to discuss with lawmakers any specifics of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report on the Russia investigation, but said he expects to issue a redacted version of the document within a week. Testifying on Capitol Hill for the first time since issuing a summary of the special counsel's findings, Barr faced intense criticism from Democrats who suggested the attorney general had acted to shield President Donald Trump from the full weight of the probe's conclusions. House Appropriations Committee Chairperson Nita Lowey said Barr's summary is more suspicious than impressive and urged him to bring transparency to this process as soon as possible. Late last month, 2 days after receiving Mueller's report, Barr advised lawmakers that the special counsel had not uncovered collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia to sway the 2016 election, but was neutral on whether the president had obstructed American justice. News reports have said that some members of Mueller's team alleged Barr's summary glossed over damaging information about Trump. Democrats in both houses of Congress have demanded access to the complete report, an idea that Barr has so far appeared to dismiss. Joining us to talk more about this is former federal prosecutor Kenneth McCallion, a constitutional law expert who worked on Trump-Russia corruption cases. What do you make of all this?
It's really unfortunate, and ultimately I think the Mueller report will have to come out because Barr has gone out on a limb and summarized in his four-page letter what he believes are the findings of the Mueller report. But there are many, including me, who highly suspect that he put a tremendous amount of political spin in his four-page letter. We've never seen the Mueller report. I think there's a lot of basis for believing that the Mueller report itself and the details and the texture and the analysis by Mueller was designed to have, whether it be Congress or the public, form their own opinions, particularly on the issue of obstruction of justice. On the issue of collusion, we haven't seen the Mueller report, but according to Barr, Mueller took an extremely restrictive view of what collusion consists of. And really, the conclusion or the definition of collusion really drove the conclusion that there was no collusion. Specifically, what I mean is in Barr's letter, he says that collusion was narrowly defined as really any activity aiding and abetting by the Trump campaign team with the Russian hackers, with the agency that was doing the hacking or doing the dissemination. That was really never part of the allegations. It's never been alleged that the Trump campaign actively worked with the hackers. The issue is really, did the Trump campaign solicit from the Russians the benefit of that hacking, namely the dirt and the hacked emails on Hillary Clinton? So we haven't seen the Mueller report yet, but it seems that Mueller, by taking an extremely restrictive view of what collusion consisted of, ignored a lot of the critical evidence of the interaction between the Trump team and the Russians.
We don't really know what he looked at or what he found that may have been maybe just below the legal level of criminality, or we don't know because we haven't seen it. And apparently the law does provide for certain congressional committees, particularly the House Intelligence Committee, to be able to see the unredacted report. Apparently they get classified information all the time. So my understanding is this is the first sort of special counsel report that hasn't been fully released to Congress in this type of situation.
Yeah, certainly the Department of Justice, Barr, has all kinds, based on precedent, there's all kinds of ways that any confidential information can be restricted. It could be released to the committee members with certain restrictions on public dissemination. But you're right, congressional committees have a right to see the full report, just as Barr has read the full report, because under Article 1, they have a responsibility of oversight in an investigation, and they have a right to the full report.
What about the grand jury issues? He says they will not get, he will not release grand jury testimony. My understanding from everything I've heard is that it wouldn't take much for him to get, for the attorney general to get a judge to actually release them to Congress, not necessarily the public, but at least Congress, so that they can investigate. You know, there's a lot of talk about how people think maybe Mueller was really intending for Congress to make a decision about obstruction anyway. So would it make sense for Congress to be able to get their hands on the grand jury testimony?
Oh, absolutely. Barr, in 12 or 24 hours, could get authorization from a federal judge to release it to congressional committees. There's a compelling public need for it, and it's a weighing process between confidentiality and public need. And as you say, it could be released to the committee for its own evaluation initially, without necessarily a release to the public, but at least our elected representatives in Congress would have a full opportunity to review the entirety of the Mueller report, it would be unfortunate that they would have to first start impeachment proceedings in order to get the full Mueller report. But if necessary, they could do that as well.
It's former federal prosecutor Kenneth McCallion, a constitutional law expert who worked on Trump-Russia corruption cases. The live-streamed video of the Christchurch, New Zealand mosque shooting last month highlighted social media companies' continuing struggle to police extremist content on their platforms. Facebook and Google representatives told U.S. lawmakers Tuesday the effort to balance free speech with moderation of white supremacist content is ongoing. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more from Capitol Hill.
A church, a synagogue, and a mosque. Attacks inspired by white supremacist ideology fostered on social media.
In the age of instant communication with worldwide reach, white nationalist groups target communities of color and religious minorities through social media platforms.
Since 2007, right-wing extremist attacks have taken place across the nation. But the problem is global, and the live stream of the New Zealand shooting posed a massive challenge.
We actually prevented 1.2 million and were able to find 300,000 additional uploads of that video within the first 24 hours, and had a very forceful and swift response.
The decision to remove videos of mass shootings is clear-cut. Policing the free speech of more than 2 billion people is far more complex.
Hate speech, because it often relies on spoken rather than visual cues, is sometimes harder to detect than some forms of branded terrorist propaganda. It's intensely context-specific, and it can be contentious, as there is often disagreement on what could be considered political speech. On the opposite end, over-aggressive enforcement can also inadvertently silence voices that are using the platform to make themselves heard on these important issues.
Social media companies are protected by law from liability for content posted on their platforms.
This is a piece of legislation that really allows the internet as we understand it to exist. And fiddling with it on the edges could, I think, have a really bad implications for customers who enjoy using these services. Because what will happen is if they amend a legislation to actually make Facebook, Twitter, YouTube liable for extremist content, say, you run the risk of overreaction. And Facebook and Twitter will be they'll shut down tons and tons and tons of channels and content.
White supremacy has never been allowed on Facebook, but recently the company expanded the scope of the ban, redirecting users to a nonprofit that helps people leave hate groups.
We extended that policy to include a ban on all praise, support, and representation of white nationalism and white separatism. We see these ideologies as being inextricably linked to supremacy with intensive violence more generally.
President Trump's rhetoric about immigrants and his reaction in the aftermath of the deadly 2017 Charlottesville rally encourages hate speech, say Democrats. The president denies this, and the danger of white supremacy was acknowledged just last week by the nation's top law enforcement official.
We assess that it's a persistent, pervasive threat.
This just illustrates part of the problem.
A problem so immediate that racist content flooding the YouTube live stream of the hearing shut the comments section down. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Capitol Hill.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and The Voice of America.
VOA VOA's International Edition continues. The U.S. Department of Interior is working to finalize a rule that would dismantle Obama-era protections that prohibit killing mother bears and their cubs at the den and other hunting methods on the National Park Service Preserve lands in Alaska that are deemed excessively cruel. In the light of the upcoming Trump administration actions, the Humane Society of the United States is releasing video footage of a father and son caught on camera illegally killing a hibernating mother black bear and her two cubs. The organization says it released the video to show what they call cruelty involved in an action that could soon be permitted on National Preserve lands in Alaska. Joining us to discuss, Wendy Kiefover, Native Carnivore Protection Manager with the Humane Society's Wildlife Department. First off, can you just give us a little background on this law or rule?
In around 1990, the Alaska legislature passed a law. It would privilege hunters over all other uses for wildlife on lands in Alaska. And the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and its commission started to push these laws onto federal public lands in Alaska, including on 76 million acres of National Wildlife Refuge lands and over 20 million acres of National Park Service lands and preserves. And so during the Obama administration, first the Park Service issued a rule to protect against extreme and egregious hunting practices on national preserves in Alaska. And the rule banned things like killing, you know, wolves and coyotes at den sites in the early summer when, you know, the whole family is there kind of raising and provisioning for their pups and they're extremely vulnerable. Using bait to attract brown bears and killing them. Using artificial light to kill black bears and their mothers while they're hibernating in the den and shooting vulnerable swimming elk and things like that.
My understanding is, though, that when Obama took office, he changed some of that.
In 2015, the National Park Service issued a rule for lands on national preserves in Alaska. And then in 2016, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service issued a rule for National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska. And what these rules did was ban some of the most egregious hunting practices.
And that's been in place ever since?
It was until February 2017, and then the Alaska delegation brought a CRA to change the rules on the 2016 Fish and Wildlife Service rule, and they rolled it back. So Congress passed, this administration signed a bill that overturned the 2016 rule on 76 million acres of refuge lands in Alaska. So it means that people can shoot caribou from motorboats or use airplanes to scout and shoot grizzly bears, using bait piles to hunt grizzly bears, killing black bear mothers and their cubs while they're hibernating in the den, and some other egregious practices.
And I understand there was actually a recent incident that got a lot of attention and was caught on video, that very shocking footage capturing the poaching of a mother bear and cubs. What happened here?
So Alaska Department of Fish and Game and the U.S. Forest Service had put out remote cameras on Esther Island, which is in the Prince William Sound of Alaska. They're trying to discover why the black bear population there was in decline. They've captured inadvertently two poachers who skied up to a den and shot the mother basically at point blank range, and then her two newly born cubs began screaming, and it's really awful. And then they shot the cubs, and they immediately pulled the mother out of the den and butchered her and carried her away. And then they came back 2 days later and put the bodies of the cubs into a bag and tampered with evidence, cleaned up bullets and things like that.
Why? Why would someone want to kill a mother bear and such young cubs? What would be the reasoning behind that for hunters?
You know, I think a lot of hunters have this mistaken idea that they're in competition with carnivores for game animals such as moose and deer. And the science is just not there. You know, there was two 20-year-long studies done in Alaska looking at predation effects. And there's been other studies in Alaska, too, that show that with this kind of ecosystem in an Arctic environment, there's only so much carrying capacity. And really, predators are not the driving factor in regulating herd sizes.
Now, my understanding understanding the incident with the mother bear and the cubs, that the people were found and arrested and charged and pled guilty to unlawfully killing and transporting the bears. If the law was overturned, how were they punished?
Where Andrew and Owen Renner did this deed, it was on U.S. Forest Service lands, and so it wasn't permitted where they did it. The state even prosecuted them for poaching. But this kind of egregious, horrible behavior would become the law of the land on our National Park Service preserve in Alaska if the 2015 rule gets overturned by this administration. And so we're asking folks to go to humanesociety.org and act on our action alert, which will go to the Department of Interior Secretary David Bernhardt, asking him not to overturn the rule and protect our very iconic and beloved black bears, wolves, and other species on National Preserve in Alaska.
All right. Well, that is Wendy Kiefover, Native Carnivore Protection Manager with the Humane Society of the United States. Thank you for being with us. Singer Norah Jones, who became a household name after her 2002 debut, Come Away With Me, an album that brought home 5 Grammy Awards, has been a jazz sweetheart pretty much overnight, and now she's been wandering toward folk influences and dabbling into electronic music and returning to jazz. And now she is releasing a collection of singles and a new album titled Begin Again. It isn't just limited to one musical genre. The 7-song project harnesses Jones's ability to tap into a variety of musical streams while maintaining a mostly jazz feel. Norah Jones, in all so far, has acquired 9 Grammy Awards and 7 albums. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Kelvin Fowler. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
On a mountain top, come away with me, and I'll never stop loving you.
Hello, this is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Or you can call us on 001-202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That's Daybreak Africa at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC, right here on VOA Africa.